This is Peter Jacoby, and permit me in starting this program of the Profile series to quote a paragraph shaped by our guest. He writes of Mozart's Requiem, noting that death took the composer before he could complete this glorious work. Our author states, "The opening is a marvel. It makes one ache to think what the Requiem might have become. Against an accompaniment of quiet, detached single notes and chords in the strings, two bassoons and two basset horns weave a tissue of sustained lines. Tenderly expressive dissonances occur in their crisscrossing. The music is dark in color, prayerful and deeply private. I also sense here the presence of Mozart the dramatist, the opera composer, with the uncanny gift of setting a character on stage through the suggestive power of an aria's orchestral introduction alone. The whole world of Requiem Aeternam Dona Eis Domine is here, completely here, before the choristers have uttered a word." Well, there's such clarity of phrasing. The information embedded lodges itself into the reader's brain with ease and comfort. The words are Michael Steinberg's, musicologist, teacher, music critic, program annotator. He's a skillful and entertaining writer who managed to bring cultural history and musical analysis together in hard-to-resist essays. Mr. Steinberg's latest collection of essays, published in 2005, is a listener's guide to choral masterworks, issued by Oxford University Press, the same highly regarded outfit that in 1995 published his Listener's Guide to the Symphony and in 1998 his Listener's Guide to the Concerto. Welcome, Michael Steinberg.
Thank you.
You know, the work of these books of yours require would seem immensely taxing, terribly consuming as to research and planning and not to say the writing itself. Can you talk a bit about the process involved?
Yeah. It does, of course, take a certain amount of homework. On the other hand, with on the plus side, if you like, I've come to a lot of these pieces, like the Mozart Requiem and some of the others that are in this book, like Messiah and Bach B minor Mass and Verdi Requiem and Stravinsky Symphony of Psalms and so on. I've come to those works having known them a long time, so there was already something in the bank. Naturally, then, there needs to be a bit of homework to get few necessary facts and dates straight. But, you know, what I really like to do is have these program notes be primarily result of an interaction, if you like, between the piece of music, between the score and myself, and depending on secondary sources, what other people have written about the works, biographies, and all the rest of that sort of thing, as little as possible. I try to make program notes, well, I mean, they need to be objective in a certain way, and they need to provide some solid core information. But I also try to make them personal and subjective. I mean, the ideal thing, obviously, would be if one could make them as personal as the pieces of music themselves are, but mostly it's work that I do with the music itself, and sometimes it goes quickly, sometimes it doesn't. I poke around at the pieces at the piano. I happily and shamelessly admit that I love to listen to recordings, because the actual physical impact, the sensuous impact of the music, that's something that really turns me on and gets me going. And then at some point you have to sit down to write. And for me, what's involved there is finding the first sentence, finding the door in the wall, finding the way in. And once I know where I want to go in and how to start, in most cases, when I get to that place, it flows reasonably quickly.
Well, you also have a wonderful way of insinuating the composer's life into your discussions. I mean, when you're writing about Haydn's The Seasons, for instance, when you just talk about the winter section of it, that there's something more than murky weather on his mind, that this is an aging composer and there's something pressing on his soul. Those are wonderful words.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, you can't prove that. I mean, that's imaginative interpretation. And, of course, it's very controversial. I'm of an age where when I was in school, we were brought up very much in the either light or shadow, however you want to look at it, of the new criticism, so-called, when we were all taught that you were not supposed to pay any attention to biography and historical circumstance. And I was never happy and never comfortable with that. I always just believed that at least to some degree what's in a life is going to come out in the work. The correlations are not simple-minded by any means. Actually, I was dealing with this just last week in another context. I was doing pre-concert lectures for the Minnesota Orchestra here at home in Minneapolis, and they were playing the Mahler Sixth Symphony, which is about as down as music can get. Mm-hmm. But it's a piece that was written during absolutely the most totally unbuttonedly happy period of Mahler's life. Yet, obviously, the resource to mine these paths of tragedy, of the darkest, deepest, most dire sort of tragedy, that was all in Mahler. And, you know, the life is going to leave its mark on the work. And so I believe it's an important thing to write about. And I've also found out, just from experience, from reactions to stuff I've written, and very much from teaching I've done and from doing pre-concert lectures for orchestras in various places in the country, that people respond to that, what should we call it, the human element, very much. And it's often a way of finding the door in the wall for them, for the readers and for the listeners.
Indeed. And, you know, I was looking in your other book, this one on the symphony, where you deal with Charles Ives. And there's a wonderful paragraph of a biographical nature, which again, I think, explains so much about his music. And that's what you were getting at when you write, not only was George Ives a musician, this is, of course, the father, he was an unsettlingly unconventional one. With an unbounded hunger for experimentation inside the home as well as out of it. He accompanied his family in C while they sang old folks at home in E-flat, tried to teach them tunes and quarter tones, played his cornet across the water so as to study the echo, work with bells and glasses and so on. Well, this, of course, is what Charles grew up in, and it had such an impact on him as a mature composer.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think much of his life, at least the composing years of it, were an attempt to, you know, replicate his father's life and his father's adventurous and wonderfully free, liberated personality. And, you know, I don't know a darn thing about the insurance business, but I've been told by people who do that Charles Ives was as adventurous and inventive in insurance as he was in music. Though, to be honest, I have to add, I don't know what that would really mean. But, you know, that's just at the center of the personality.
Well, we're supposed to take musical breaks here and there in this discussion of ours. And I know that Bach is very important in your Choral Masterworks book. And you have on your list a piece by Johann Sebastian Bach, Sheep May Safely Graze. Could you talk a little bit about what you've chosen, and then we're going to play it?
Yeah. You know, when I was asked to choose pieces for musical breaks, because you get vertigo immediately, you know, because you think of 999 things you'd like to play and you can only do three fairly short ones. I took this one because this particular recording by the Canadian pianist Angela Hewitt, and I'll come clean and say that she's also a very dear personal friend of mine and my wife's, as well as a wonderful artist. This recording has meant a lot to me, first for a number of reasons. I don't need to say anything in defense of Bach. I will say that I've always been fascinated by what you might call hyphenated pieces, when you get arrangements by one composer of the work of another, and these sometimes handshakes that go across whole centuries, and what comes when you bring these different worlds together, the possibilities of that, that's something that I've always been fascinated in. And there's also a personal note in that this recording came out in 2001, right around the time of the 9/11 misery. And I remember at that time thinking about, you know, what music do I want to hear? You know, what is there out there that's steadying? And the first name I thought of was Bach, and this CD had just arrived, and I put that on. And there was so much steadiness and so much beauty and, yeah, let's just say so much comfort in that, in a way. And so I've always had a kind of special love for this recording and this arrangement for solo piano by Mary Howe of Sheep May Safely Graze is, I think, a particularly lovely one and very beautifully played by Angela.
We have just heard Sheep May Safely Graze by Johann Sebastian Bach, arranged for piano by Mary Howe and played by Angela Hewitt, and one of the selections of our guest, Michael Steinberg. Mr. Steinberg, you were born in Breslau.
Yes.
And left Germany during the Nazi years, I gather, huh? When did you come to this country?
Well, there was a gap between those two events. I left my home in Breslau, Germany, which is now Wrocław, Poland, at the beginning of May 1939, so not very long before the war began. And I went out on one of those Kindertransporter, those things that were arranged by the Quakers primarily in England, and that rescued several thousand Jewish children from Germany and Austria and found homes for them in England. I was very fortunate in the home that I was placed in. And my mother was able to get out of Germany something like 5 days before the war started, came to England also. And then eventually she and I went to America together in 1943, actually in the middle of the war. That always astonishes people, but it was deemed by somebody that by 1943 the U-boat danger in the North Atlantic was essentially over and that a very limited amount of passenger traffic could begin again. And we'd been on a waiting list, and it all then happened very suddenly. My mother got a telegram from the American embassy in London saying reporter, I think it was Euston Station in London, and on Thursday morning or something like that, Friday morning or whatever, and we, you know, just had to move very rapidly to do that. We had about 3 days' notice, went up there, went to Liverpool, were put on board a ship and were out at sea about an hour later, and so landed in America at the end of November 1943. So I had my first American Thanksgiving on board ship and the way. And my much older brother was already settled in this country in St. Louis, so we went there. And that's really where it all began for me in this country.
This must have had an impact of some importance to you as your life moved on. I see that you mention in the prelude to your choral masterworks, you speak of a recording of Bach's St. Matthew Passion, I believe it is, mm-hmm. that was made in 1941 during the war. And you wondered, as beautiful as it was, and you say it's a glorious recording, you wondered about the people who participated and whether some of them were Nazis and whether that made any difference.
Yes. I mean, it certainly did have an impact on me, and this whole thing of my relationship to Germany and the German language was a very, to say the least, tricky thing in my life for a long time. When I went to England by myself in May of 39, I was plunged into the life of an English family, and a couple of weeks after that, into an English boarding school, you know, speaking only English, of which I'd had a very little bit in school. And I just totally buried my German. And when my mother arrived 3 or 4 months later, I really was not able to speak German with any comfort with her. I mean, it just wasn't on my tongue, wasn't in my mouth anymore. And we had a very difficult scene over that because she thought there was an affectation on my part and or pretense or something like that. And I got very angry about that. And then I just absolutely refused to speak German. And I really, in a sense, relearned it as though it were a second language for me, which in a sense it is. I mean, English by now really is my number one language. And I sort of relearned German as a second language, as it were, while I was in college. I began reading German books again. But even then, I had great hesitation over the question of, do I want to go back to Germany? Do I ever want to go back to Germany? Under what circumstances? What would that be like? Well, in the end, I had no choice because I got drafted into the American Army and sent to Germany. And so there I was back in the old country, but in an American uniform this time, which, you know, may have made it easier in a way. It certainly made it a bit peculiar. And I think from that point on, I was, you know, really pretty comfortable with it. But the whole, and it's a difficult issue for both with the language and with, I mean, and not anymore. But it was at that time, and this thing that you mentioned about the recording of the St. Matthew Passion, that was indeed very, very troubling to me at that time. And as sort of the whole, you know, a kind of two-edged thing that on the one hand, that here there is the most extraordinary and, you know, just heartbreakingly beautiful music, every bit of which is sort of designed to sort of reach deep into your heart and deep into your spirit and your mind and to sort of, as it were, invite you in, but all coming out of a culture that had done everything to throw me out. And it was not always easy to balance those two things and to bring them into harmony with one another, which I think over the years I have. I mean, this episode of listening to that recording goes back to 1947 or something like that. I suppose that's a long time ago, and I've done a bit of growing up since then.
Well, let's listen to another piece of music, and this is by someone else who left Germany, called Weil, and he is on your list of favorites. Tell us about this. This is a number from the Three Penny Opera.
Yeah, the court, I chose this because, well, first of all, the Three Penny Opera and I are pretty much contemporaries. It had its first performances in Berlin in August 1928. I was born at the beginning of October. And those songs from the Three Penny Opera were all the rage in Germany in those very early years of my life. And my own earliest musical memories are of my older brother singing them to me, particularly this one that I chose here, the, what is the English title, The Ballad of Human Insufficiency or something of that sort, you know, that our heads will, you know, the best thing our heads can do is feed a louse. You know, they'll never be adequate for dealing with the actual problems that we're faced to face with in life. And I was also told at some point later in my life that the first song I actually could sing myself was the thing that opens the Three Penny Opera, the one we now know as Mack the Knife. But it's the other one from Act Three that I chose and the one that I can sort of still hear in my older brother's voice.
And this is an early recording, 1930, I believe, by Erich Ponto.
Who is a glorious actor. He's one of these people like Rex Harrison in My Fair Lady. He couldn't really sing, but with the most wonderful word sense. And I was lucky enough in my years in the army in Stuttgart, he was at the Stuttgart theater, part of the company there, and I was able to see him a number of times, and which gave me very great pleasure.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of Kurtweil.
Ballade von der Unzulänglichkeit menschlichen Strebens.
Der Mensch lebt durch den Kopf. Sein Kopf reicht ihm nicht aus. Versuch es nur, von deinem Kopf lebt höchstens eine Laus. Denn für dieses Leben ist der Mensch nicht schlau genug. Niemals merkt er eben diesen Lug und Trug. Ja, mach nur einen Plan, sei nur ein großes.
We have just heard a song from Kurt Weill's Three Penny Opera, sung by Erich Ponto, a recording made in 1930, and another favorite of our guest, Michael Steinberg. You know, I'm taken by the breadth of your thinking. I was reading your essay on the Verdi Requiem, and you say, the Requiem, even though distinct from opera, and Verdi did want a less dramatic style of singing here and less rubato, is nourished by opera, unimaginable without opera, and ultimately unperformable by conductors and singers who do not understand and adore opera. And then you talk about Verdi's lifelong search for good texts, and you say that the very best text he ever had came not in the opera, but in the Requiem that he wrote.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's maybe a bit of a rhetorical flourish there. I mean, some, you know, the text for Otello, Boyd's adaptation of Shakespeare's Othello, or, you know, at the other end of the sad to funny scale, the one for Falstaff, mm-hmm. based primarily on Merry Wives of Windsor. Those are pretty good texts too. But obviously there is, you know, he reads, he reads the text of the Requiem as though, you know, he were auditioning a libretto, as it were, and he goes about setting it that way. And it's nourished by that, and in spite of his own, you know, near atheism, let's call it, it's also nourished by the tradition of church music. And I had a very moving experience of this. We'd been talking with some friends about singers, and somebody was singing, singing the praises of Jussi Björling's recording of the Ingemisco from the big tenor aria from the middle of the Dies Irae and the Verdi Requiem. And I thought it would be fun to sort of listen to that side by side with Beniamino Gigli's very Italian, really Puccini-esque, and in its own way quite wonderful singing of that. And I suddenly realized that the difference there is not just the individual temperamental difference between those two singers, or even the difference between a Swede and an Italian, but it's the difference between having, in the case of Gigli, someone who has known these words from his boyhood as a choir boy, has lived them, you know, on occasion after occasion, Sunday after Sunday, many of these liturgical texts. I mean, sometimes you can't help but see him on his knees in your mind's eye as he sings some of these prayers, whereas for Björling, who also sings it absolutely wonderfully, it's a text in a foreign language that he has learned, but that has no deep-reaching emotional baggage for him at all. And so in the Verdi Requiem, you really get both. I mean, you get the churchy thing and the operatic thing. And that's a very heady mixture. And I think maybe it's even the combustion that is produced by the mixture that makes the piece so rich and so wonderful.
Is it one of your favorites? I'm wondering, as I go through the Choral Masterworks book, what are some of your favorites?
They're all my favorites except one, and I'm not going to tell you which one. And I mean, some of the, you know, they're the obvious ones, of course. I mean, you know, you can't not love the B minor Mass and the Bach Passions and Messiah, the Verdi Requiem, the Mozart Requiem, which we started out with, and then some of the much less known things that mean a great deal to me, the Franz Schmidt book with seven seals. And I think the one piece that was really new to me when I sat down to do the book, which is the Vaughan Williams Sancta Civitas. A conductor friend of mine had recommended that to me as something that really should not be omitted. And I had not known it. I probably had heard it at some time or another. And that, to me, was just an overwhelming discovery. And, you know, to make such discoveries is one of the joys. It's one of the things I've loved about being a program annotator, which I have been basically since, 1976, when I went to work for the Boston Symphony, is learning new pieces, or sometimes having to write about a piece that you didn't particularly have a strong feeling for, but now you have to study it because you've got to write this damn program note. And during the course of study, you find yourself preparing an empty room for it in your mind, and welcoming it in. And suddenly it becomes part of your life and a wonderful treasure. But anyway, to get back to your question, I think I really, I mean, with, you know, one possible exception, I really love all of this music very much, and just as I love the whole, everything that has to do with the intersection of music and text.
We met some 30 years ago or so when I planned a conference on the arts and the press at Northwestern right. University, and you were gracious enough to accept an invitation to address the gathered artists and managers and journalists about music criticism. And you were at the time the music critic for the Boston Globe, as I recall.
Right.
And you weren't terribly complimentary about the attention being paid the arts by the press, nor mm-hmm. were you terribly sanguine, if I remember correctly, about the future. Well, we're long into that future now. You've given up that part of your life, that of the newspaper critic. How do you view what's being done these days in behalf of arts coverage, more specifically, perhaps, music?
Well, I guess sorry to say I was right. I mean, it's gotten worse. let's just leave the issue of quality to one side at the moment. But what has certainly become more difficult is that fewer and fewer newspapers, by and large, give less and less space to classical music or concert music or whatever we want to call it. And most of there are exceptions. There seem to be, I think the New York Times is still probably a fairly comfortable place for a music critic to work. I suspect the Los Angeles Times is. But every other place where I know newspaper music critics, Boston, my old paper, or San Francisco, for example, I hear those critics moaning about ever more stringent space restrictions and that they don't have stringers for backup. I mean, when I was working on the Globe, I could, in effect, hire as many extra people as I wanted if there were just lots of events that wanted to be covered during the course of a week. And that is something that hardly happens anymore. And I think, this is just a guess, I think one thing that's happened is that the people who are making decisions about this sort of thing, the managing editors, are of that, well, I always think of that as a kind of lost generation, the generation when music first really began to disappear from public school education. And it's that generation, sort of the middle to older end of the baby boomers, that I think is the generation that seems to have least contact with classical music now. Lots of older people still do. And to my great delight, I see lots of younger people at concerts. But that middle stratum seems to be missing. And those are the people that are making some of these decisions. So the newspapers, I think, are not in a position at this point to be, very helpful in getting a public interested in what goes on in the world of concert music.
Well, let's turn away from that kind of concert music to hear the third request of Michael mm-hmm. Steinberg, and that's The Way You Look Tonight, a special performance that apparently pleases you. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is actually a performance that I learned about in a poem by Billy Collins. And one of the great pleasures of my life in recent years has been sort of just collecting for my own pleasure, primarily at this point, maybe I will do something with it at some later point, is collecting poems about music. And there are lots. It's amazing how many poets do find music and musicians fascinating subjects. One of the poets, among the ones who I love particularly, among American poets, I would name Liesl Müller and Mary Oliver, Denise Levertov, if we count her as American, and certainly Billy Collins, who has written a lot about music, some of it about jazz, some of it about classical music, and he has a delightful poem called Man Listening to Disc, in which he describes himself walking along, I think it's 46th Street in Manhattan, with earphones on and listening to this recording of The Way You Look Tonight with Sonny Rollins and with Thelonious Monk on piano and Tommy Potter on drums and Arthur Taylor on bass. And he has the most witty and delightful description of the kind of counterpoint of, on the one hand, one strand is the music going along, and his very courtly thanks to these four musicians who are moving all this unwieldy hardware along this crowded Manhattan street to keep him company as he walks, and then his description of the other people whom he passes on the street. It's such a poem I've always taken a delight in, and this is what he's listening to, and it's, in fact, a wonderful recording, and that's why I chose it.
Oh, good. Well, let's listen to it. The Way You Look Tonight. We have just heard a 1954 performance of The Way You Look Tonight by Sonny Rollins, Thelonious Monk, Tommy Potter, and Arthur Taylor, one of the choices that our guest Michael Steinberg has asked us to play, and we have just done so. Now, as someone who has served orchestras, Boston, San Francisco, New York, Minneapolis, and I don't know who else, what is your view about the state of classical music in these early years of the 21st century?
Well, I think we come back to the question of the collapse of education in music in the public schools, which, you know, has really made it difficult to – made not impossible by any means, but that has added to the difficulty of pulling in an audience, because habits of listening to this kind of music, that's something that's best formed early. And when the exposure is limited, of course, this creates a – this can create a certain amount of difficulty. It's a puzzling picture in this country. I mean, there are orchestras, obviously, that are flourishing. There have been, you know, we've seen orchestras floundering. We've seen orchestras actually go under completely. My impression in the end, I have to say, is an optimistic one, that I've seen that what I tend to see as I look over the field is that where the artistic endeavor is on a very high level and where ideals of, you know, if we're going to do it, let's do it seriously, let's do it properly, where such ideals are maintained, where management is really competent, where there is a strong alliance between the music director and the CEO, the executive director, managing director, or whatever he or she may be called in this in any one particular orchestra, where those two sides, the artistic side and the managerial business side, are in harmony, where they see each other as allies, things can go very well indeed. I mean, I see this in a lot of the orchestras that I'm lucky to work with these days by way of occasionally doing program notes for them or doing pre-concert lectures. Boston, for example, here in Minneapolis, San Francisco, Los Angeles. It is possible to do it right, and it's very heartening always to see that happening.
And new music that is being written, do you find that it is being accepted by audiences when orchestras provide the opportunities for us to hear them?
It depends what it is. And, you know, obviously some music is a lot easier for a, you know, your basic symphony audience to connect with than other things. But even there, we can have surprises. I mean, we had one of those surprises here at home in Minneapolis just a couple of weeks ago when the orchestra played a piece by the German, now something like 50-year-old composer, Wolfgang Grimm. And it was a double concerto for viola and clarinet. And it was a longish piece, I mean, about 36 minutes, and kind of ruminative in nature, nothing very spectacular or brilliant going on. Yet in the most extraordinary way, the audience sat there in total silence and was very warmly responsive to it at the end in a way that one would never have predicted for this piece.
Well, we're nearing the end of our time together, and I wanted to go back to your choral masterworks.
Yeah.
Listener's Guide. And you say in the introduction, as a wonderful paragraph, I had the wonderful experience of learning the St. John Passion by singing in the chorus, and there's no better way of possessing a piece of music than singing or playing it. Then I knew again that Bach's passions were addressed to me as well as to the parishioners of St. Nicholas's and St. Thomas's. I hear them differently, no doubt. I readily believe that there are dimensions I miss, but I also maintain that a musical person gets more from the St. John or St. Matthew Passion than the most devout, imaginable Christian with a tin ear. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yes. I have, in fact, I mean, as you know, a whole little mini essay on that subject somewhere in the book, called A Word to Non-Believers and Believers. And I think the point that I'm trying to convey there is that the issues in these works and issues or questions of ecstasy, if I can use that word, and of transcendence, those go very far beyond any kind of religious orthodoxy, and that in these works, I'm particularly thinking of the Bach Passions there, we are dealing with questions, you know, such as love and betrayal and trust and confidence and so forth, that also I think go very far beyond what is contained with any one particular kind of religious orthodoxy. And if you are sensible to the musical language which Bach speaks so persuasively, and, you know, I'll quote something that I do quote somewhere in the book, I think, which is something that the critic Andrew Porter, who was many years the critic of The New Yorker, once wrote. He said, a great opera composer can make you believe anything. And, you know, we don't have to limit that to opera composers. So that if you are sensible to the musical language when it is spoken with the power with which Bach speaks it, or Mozart, or Beethoven, or Verdi, and the other masters that are present in the book there, then there is just no end to the richness of the spiritual nourishment that even a card-carrying atheist like myself can draw from these great works.
But then, isn't that what music is about? That so much can be read into it by each individual.
It is indeed, yes. I mean, it doesn't nail you down in the particular way that words do. And in some mysterious way that I've never known anyone to explain, it can carve away right to, you know, where the center of your emotional life is. It can open you and make you more receptive and sometimes perhaps even make you more expressive and, you know, really liberate all those mysterious lines and currents that make up our emotional lives and that make up those extraordinary places in the network where the emotional life and the intellectual life connect and crisscross.
Well, I think you've opened us up, given us some things to think about. And I wanted to repeat once more, this is Choral Masterworks, A Listener's Guide by Michael Steinberg. But you've written two others, one about the symphony and one about the concerto, and you've got some other books in your head or on paper already. Can you just briefly mention those?
Well, one on paper, which is about to go to the publisher in a couple of weeks, which is a collection of miscellaneous essays. This is a joint project by my friend Larry Roth, who's the program editor of the San Francisco Symphony, and also he's a wonderful writer about music. A joint project that he and I have done. There'll be 15 essays by each of us on various musical subjects. And then the one that's partly on paper and partly still in my head is fourth in this series with the concerto and the symphony and the choral masterworks. And it's got a tentative working title, Beyond the Symphony. And there will have room for essays on tone poems and Stravinsky ballets and the Brahms Haydn variations and all that glorious orchestral repertoire other than symphonies.
Well, I'll wait for both of those books. And I thank you very much. I'm delighted to catch up with you again. In our studio, we have had Michael Steinberg as a guest. And my name is Peter Jacoby for Profiles.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in May of 2005. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. The recording engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily Blacklin, research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. In addition, this and other Profiles programs can be accessed through our website at wfiu.indiana.edu. For WFIU, thanks for listening.